Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Simon Thompson. How are you, Simon?
I'm great, John. Raring to go.
Yeah, nice of you to come to the office.
That's what I meant.
Excellent. And we're going to be talking about some of your ideas that you've put forward this week, and some more general stuff, particularly Bango and Boku, which has been an interesting story of the week.
It has been. Boku's floated this week. They've got very, very similar business models, and it's worth comparing the two.
Absolutely. And Jonas Crosland, how are you, Jonas?
Very well, thanks, John.
Excellent. We're going to talk. We're going to talk a bit about the budget, in particular, property and the housing market.
Yep.
Did you say ugh?
Well, it's a bit of a cloudy issue. You know?
A cloudy issue. It certainly is. It certainly is. Anyway, yeah, it's been a busy week at the magazine. Lots of results at this time of year. Lots and lots of news. But Tom, we might as well, since you're here, we might as well kick off with you, because you are the bearer of the news about the small cap stories of the week. Where should we start?
Well, I mean, the big one was this tissue maker from Blackburn called Acrol, and it floated middle of last year at pounds. Zeus Capital was the broker, and everything was going sweet, John. I put the readers in at £1. They had full year results, which actually beat expectations in July.
Well, we've talked about it on this podcast before.
Absolutely.
It did sound like a great story.
Winning contracts from the discounters, and, you know, decent profitability. And
they work with some big names as well.
Absolutely. So you're talking all the major supermarkets, your discounters, Lidl, Aldi. So they got some big contracts. And but anyway, covered the results in over the summer. And, you know, the housebroker tweaked its forecasts for the coming year a tad, but basically we're still saying that this company was going to do about £155 million worth of revenue and £14.5 million worth of pre-tax profits in the current financial year. And you know, it was trading on about 11 times earnings, dividend yield 4%. So I said, run profits. You're up 44%, run profits. And that was July. In September, they had a trading statement. They had an in-line trading statement, John, and nothing to be concerned about.
But all has not been as it seemed.
4 weeks later, bombshell hit, share suspended. They've got a cash squeeze. And the news that came out this week was that their net debt, which was not an issue, £19 million net debt, creating to 1.2 times cash profits back in April, had ballooned, wait for it, from £19 to £42 million.
How does that happen in such a short space of time?
It's either incompetent working capital management, which that doesn't really explain everything. But the other thing is, John, the guidance, which was this business is going to do £17.5 million worth of cash profits, up from £16 million, that's no longer. Guidance is cash profit zero or a small loss. So in the space of 4 weeks, you've gone from a profitable business, dividend paying, apparently solid, to something that's a basket case.
Yeah, I struggle to get my head around this. I struggle to get my head around how you can have such a substantial change in expectations in such a short space of time, given the restrictions we know companies have to abide by in terms of how they report to the market.
Something's not right here, John. I've said the shares relisted, they tanked from 133 to 40-odd pence. I said, get out. I'm not happy. They're having a placing, an emergency placing, £80 million, 50 pence a share. The question
is... So you're suggesting people don't get involved in... It's not something they can get involved in. Who's going to give them the money?
Well, it's not a subscribed placing, so they're going to have to tap existing shareholders. The only ones I can see who'd actually... Major institutional shareholders are the only ones that actually back this placing. I don't want to be part of this. There are so many red flags in the documents that... You know, the question you've got is, if you got fresh money, would you put it in? Would you rate these shares buy, a recovery buy? And for me, the answer is no. There's just too many red flags here.
Yeah, well, one of them that you mentioned to me earlier was that they failed to declare a fine that they were likely to receive from Health and Safety in their admission document.
Yeah, I read the AIM admission document. It was a chunky document. I read it just like every float I look at. So I read it completely. And there was no mention whatsoever of this HSE fine, which could be upwards of £3 million before a discount. So it could be a chunky sum of money. And the first we hear about it was back in the autumn. And, you know, that's almost 18 months after it floated.
Yeah, I mean, it does beg the question. The AIM as a market has been criticised for laxity in respect of some of its flotations, and we've obviously had our fair share of exposure to that over the years. But, you know, you would have... It's just hard to comprehend how these things can slip through. Is it something to do with the market, or Is it something to do with the Nomad on this? I mean, you know, how could this have happened?
Well, it's something to do with the company, the directors and the private equity owners that actually floated it in the first place, that thought it would not be prudent to actually disclose it in the document and actually make the corporate broker and Nomad aware of the fact that there was this pending fine, which could be upwards between £550,000 and £2.9 million. It's down to the company in the first place not to tell the corporate broker. And if they did tell the corporate broker, why did the corporate broker not make a point in the AIM admission documents to raise this? I mean, that's just another issue.
I guess my question is, do you think this is a company-specific issue or an issue with the way that AIM is regulated?
I think in this case, it's a company-specific issue, that someone's taken a view that the fine was going to be insignificant. They could actually absorb it and not disclose it at the time of the IPO, because that would have dented the price they'd be able to float the company at. That's the obvious conclusion to actually reach.
And if that's the conclusion you're reaching, then you know, you would expect higher powers to be looking at this.
I certainly hope so. When something like this happens and a share price goes from £1.33 to 40 pence, tanks almost 70%, and the news is so dire after an inline trading statement, a company cannot go from inline £17 million of cash profits predicted to actually possibly a loss 6 months into a financial year. You can't do that.
Mm. Let's move away from bad news and bashing the Nomads, because actually I think you mentioned that Zeus is also the corporate broker to GYG, which you do like.
I like GYG a lot. I mean, the business is simple. They spray paint super yachts and they refit them. That's it. Nothing else.
We have spoken about this before. It's a business model we can easily get heads around.
Yeah, even I can get my head around this one, John. And the problem they had was the hurricane season on the East Coast. Although it didn't really affect the yards that they fit and spray these boats in, it's impacted the owners who had their boats over super yachts in the Mediterranean, who thought, hey, we'll actually keep them here for a bit longer, just wait and see until things settle with the hurricane season. And it's delayed the start date of a few contracts, which were high margin. So we're looking at about 5 million euros worth of revenue, 1 million euros of cash profit. It's actually been kicked into 2018. All these contracts have started. They haven't been postponed. They've actually, delayed infinitum, but they've started already. People got worried because this happened the same week as Aquarol, which was another Zeus company, had this terrible news, and GYG's shares got marked down. And I told our readers to buy at the float price a pound, although realistically £1.15 was the starting price they could have actually traded at when it floated in the summer. And when they got marked down this week, I said, no, it's a repeat buying opportunity. This is not actually bad news. Revenues and profits have just been delayed, pushed into 2018. And the most important thing with GYG is that the latest order book is at a record level.
That does it impinge upon their ability to deliver that, you know, in the time frame that's required to support the price, the valuation that the shares are at right now?
They can deliver on those revenues, absolutely. I can't see a problem with that. And I interviewed the directors for about an hour and a half before it floated. I interviewed the directors for the best part of an hour at the time of the interim results. I know this company, and I'm pretty confident it's a repeat buying opportunity, which is why that's the advice this week. And the shares have bounced back and they're back to where they were before. So I think other people are taking a very sensible approach to this. And on roughly 11 times forward earnings, dividend yield of 5%, I think it's cracking value.
Excellent. I'm intrigued. I would love to have heard that conversation. I'd love to hear how you can draw such a simple business model to an hour and a half's conversation. But
the reason for that, John, is that I went through the AIM admission document, which is about 130, 150 pages in fine detail. Forensic counting, in effect.
Ooh.
And I raised points that other journalists possibly wouldn't have raised, but I had to be comfortable with the business model before I put readers in.
But you can only go on what they tell you, and obviously you need to get comfortable with that. In the case of Aquarol, it's not been as easy to do that.
It should have been disclosed with Aquarol at the time of the IPO that there was an HSE fine. There was something not right in September when clearly the finance director and the chief executive who left in September, guided the market to expect in-line profit expectations when clearly the trading performance was to the contrary.
I do wonder if those management changes have had something to do with the change to what they're guiding the market at too, but that, you know, there you go. Let's move on. Let's talk Bango Boku. This is an interesting story which Harriet Klarfeld has covered in the news section, but it's, I know Bango is a company you've followed.
I really like Bango. I put the readers in around about 90 odd pence back in September. They were trading roughly around that at the start of the year. And the key thing about this is that Bango provides a mobile payment platform that enables smartphone users to charge purchases made in app stores straight to the mobile phone account. It's been winning a host of contracts.
Big in Japan.
Huge in Japan. Japanese Amazon website has annual revenues of 1 trillion yen, that's 6.7 billion sterling. And they've got the account there, an arrangement that enables customers of the two largest mobile phone companies to pay for the goods from the Amazon Japan website by charging the cost to their mobile phone account. Mm. And this, well, in the last few weeks, that's actually been extended, that arrangement, to Amazon Prime and Amazon student membership programs.
So the point Harriet makes in her news piece is that Bango shares fell on the announcement or on the arrival of Boku to the market. But this market, the direct carrier billing market, is big enough to support more than one player.
Oh, without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, there's 7.2 billion mobile accounts worldwide. Roughly half of transactions are not done with credit cards and debit cards. You've got masses of territories across the world that would welcome the ability to use DCP, direct carrier billing arrangements.
And this is because in many territories people have mobile phones, but they don't necessarily have bank accounts.
And a great example of that is in Nigeria. There's 150 million mobile subscribers, and it's got more mobile internet users than any other African country. And Android smartphones account for 60% of the mobile market share. And Bango has just signed a contract with Nine Mobile, one of the biggest operators in Nigeria, in the last few weeks.
Boku looks interesting too. I mean, you've looked in detail at Bango. Boku looks interesting too. We've initiated our coverage with a speculative buy because it's in the right market. It seems to have a viable established business. You're looking at this in some more detail now as well.
Absolutely. I mean, Boku is a lot bigger than Bango. Both companies have basically turned cash profitable in the last few weeks. The revenue or transactions that Boku carries out are a lot higher than Bango. Both have hit the inflection points. Both have made the investment in their platforms. The market 2020, according to analysts, could be worth $20 billion in transaction value. And based on a margin of 1.5 to 2%, which is basically what these companies charge, there's a heck of a lot of revenue out there to actually capture. And revenue becomes gross profit, becomes net profit.
So you're looking at this in more detail, aren't you, for your column next week?
Absolutely. So next week I'll be going into this and actually explaining why I think that there's room in the market for both players.
I await it with bated breath, Simon. Thank you very much. As we move on to the budget, let's talk budget, Jonas. And obviously the big news, there was quite an interesting budget, I thought.
Yeah, it was interesting.
Some good jokes.
We didn't
expect that. But obviously the big news in the budget is the attention that's being paid to the housing crisis. Sajid Javid, the community secretary, had presented some numbers to government the week before. And it seemed like he was pretty much sort of told to get back in his box. But Hammond has delivered something.
Yeah, he's delivered something. That $44 billion. It's not entirely clear how much of that is new money.
It never is, Jonas. It never is.
There's a fairly high level of cynicism because the government promised to build 200,000 starter homes 3 years ago, that was, and so far they haven't built any. So nobody's holding their breath. And that $44 billion is also over the next 5 years. So there's no silver bullet, as Mr. Hammond suggested.
But I mean, it's an interesting demonstration that they are looking at housing. It's clearly a national problem. We have a shortage. House prices are booming. Housing affordability, whether you're renting or buying, is in its probably lowest ebb for many, many years. It's a good start.
Yeah, it's a good start. I mean, getting rid of the stamp duty on houses up to 300,000.
For first-time buyers?
Yeah, for first-time buyers. It's basically subsidising demand and not addressing the supply issues. So arguably, it'll make it easier for more people to buy houses, which will underpin house prices.
Yes, that's true. So affordability might even get worse.
Yes.
And I think the OBR put some numbers together which suggested that would indeed be the effect of this measure. That said, house builder shares fell, and I suspect the reason is that essentially they were threatened by the Chancellor that they will be investigating how they approach land banking.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very emotive issue, because a lot of house builders have land banks equivalent to 3, 4, 5, 6 years of output. And they always claim that they need that because it takes 2 or 3 years to get stuff through the planning procedures. And local authorities' planning offices are stripped bare. They're under-resourced. And each local authority has its own planning ideas. There is no formal nationwide procedure.
And I think you mentioned as well that, I mean, what essentially the threat was, if you're sitting on land and not using it, we will intervene, the government will intervene, and potentially even compulsory purchase this land. But as you pointed out yesterday, councils have a route to do that already to a certain extent.
Yes, they can. It's odd because, especially in London, I mean, it doesn't stack up. If house prices are falling in London and you're sitting on land, it doesn't make sense, because the land is falling in value. Well, the developed value of that land is falling. So I don't think there's going to be much coming out of this, to be quite honest.
Okay, so there has...
I'd agree with Jonas. I can't remember a single report by the government into housing in terms of land banking by the house builders that's actually come out and actually been negative on the house builders. So I remember covering the Barker report years ago, and the same issue was raised then. Admittedly, the housing shortage today is far greater than it was back then, but the house builders were cleared of hoarding lands then, and the same issue is today.
Mm.
Actually, from my perspective, the winners from this are not the house builders. It's going to be companies that actually develop lands, of which the two that spring to mind that I know Jonas is keen on as well are Henry Boot and Inland, who've got massive land banks. So if the local authorities do actually accelerate planning permission, that's going to be rather good news for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, where I live, there has been a local plan that's been in place for a long, long time. Part of that local plan was developed, I think they talked about it yesterday, what do they call them? Like green towns, or no, what are they called? Garden towns.
Garden towns.
Garden towns. So we were due to have a big development at the north of the town, big development at the south. But the planning process has been torturous. Torturous. And it's only now that it's recently got through. And actually, it was because the central government did intervene. But it's taken a long time. The planning process does need fixing.
Yeah, there's 15 local authorities under scrutiny at the moment by the government because they've failed to put in a local plan. And they're obliged to put their requirements, well, to publish their requirements and say, we need 2,000 houses this year or whatever. And they haven't even done that. So house builders can't be expected to build houses when the local authority doesn't even know what they want.
Indeed. Lots of houses going up near me. I mean, it's extraordinary, actually, the amount of building near me. But I live on a commuter belt, so...
Yeah.
You would expect it, and it must be profitable business for the house builders. I mean, there was another measure that I thought was interesting, which was support for smaller house builders. So the big builders that we cover deliver a certain number of houses, but the difficulties in sort of flexing that upwards have been that it's much more difficult for a smaller house builder to get the credit it needs to develop. And do you think that's going to have an impact on the market?
Most certainly, because the quoted house builders produce 40,000-50,000 houses a year, and the last year to date there are about 220 completions. So the balance of those are by housing associations and unquoted building companies, and they've had it pretty tough because after the crash, obviously, speculative building, the banks just turn themselves away. They won't lend money to builders who say, I've bought some land, I want to build some houses, can you lend me some money? And they just say no.
So in that respect, this is a good step by the government to make it easier for those guys to build.
Yes, it certainly is. Arguably, you could say that the banks ought to have a more positive view of things now, because if they want to lend money to builders to build houses, unlike in the crash, it's not going to all end in tears because there is a housing shortage.
Mm, that's the economic forecasts, which were downgraded quite substantially in the budget, are not looking that great, but there you go.
But isn't that just a case of Hammond's under-promising so you can over-deliver?
The OBR is independent, Simon.
It may be independent.
call me skeptical, but from my lens at least, that looks as if it's happened.
Mm. I call you skeptical. I call you cynical, in fact. I mean, Jonas, you mentioned something at the beginning of this interview about starter homes. And you know, that's where the real problem lies. A small handout to, in the form of, you know, the abolished stamp duty on first-time buyers, is it's not really going to move the dial there. We talked yesterday about modular house building.
Mm.
And actually, there is a company in the UK on the market that is involved in this.
Yeah.
This is where we need to go, surely.
Certainly, Mars City, I could say they didn't do quite as well as everyone expected, but I don't think that's anything to do with the product. And I've seen their houses or their flats, and they can knock them up in a week.
What are they? What I mean? Well, so we've all watched Grand Designs, and we watched the old hoof house being brought over on a lorry, but yeah, not quite that high end, but not the prefabs of old that people are worried about.
No, they just bring in on a lorry and use cranes to deliver walls, and they're triple insulated.
Structural insulated panels.
Yes.
Yes, right. I like these things.
And they just bolt them all together, put glass in, and all the sort of fittings and fixtures are already there, and it's done.
I did an extension on my last house, and I wanted to use SIP, structural insulated panels, to do it, and I couldn't find a builder that would do it.
No.
I think this is part of the problem, and actually something else you mentioned yesterday, Jonas, is that one of the big problems for the house builders is the labour force.
Yeah, with modular housing, I mean, you basically need a fitter rather than a craftsman.
Or a bricky, or which are in short supply. Whatever.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And that shortage of labour is considerable because, well, everyone's worried about, you know, the Polish plumbers being not allowed into the country, and the builders have all done apprenticeship schemes, but it's just a drop in the ocean.
Mm, absolutely. Simon, house building. It must be getting to that time of year again.
It is. I'm going to have a very close look at the state of the house builders' share prices and valuations, the market backdrop at the end of December, and come to a decision whether or not I think the rally is going to happen yet again in the first quarter. It's a standing dish of the stock market, John.
How's it been doing over the past few years?
Amazingly well. I mean, amazing. But basically, you could have bought the house builders, start of January, sold out the end of March, phoned up your stockbroker and just said, send me the cheque, please. You know, your profits were so big, and we're talking 20, 25, 30% some years. It's just been incredible.
But our house builders not now at that point where the kind of tide is moving against them, certainly in terms of sentiment. It's not been great for the house builders since Brexit. I mean, it's been up and down. A bit more of a hit yesterday. I mean, are we still, what do we think about the house builders generally as investments?
Well, I mean, in the good old days, house builders are always regarded as very cyclical. So you buy when the market's depressed, and then you sell on the very slightest hint of anything that turns the cycle. But house builders this time round aren't overgeared. Interest rates are low. Demand is intense. There's help to buy. There's a number of incentives for first-time buyers. It's hard to see the house builders sort of tanking or collapsing simply because it's an easy model.
Big cash return still coming?
Yep. Oh, yes. I mean, Persimmon and Barclay are promising huge returns out to 2021. And they're making a lot of money. The other thing, of course, is that if the house builders start to struggle a little bit, people like Taylor Wimpey spend more on land than their pre-tax profits. So if they just stop buying land, they'd have a huge margin of comfort there.
It's a nice safety valve. Mm. Yeah. So not a bad budget for the house builders then, despite the share price falls yesterday.
Well, they went down yesterday on the land bank thing, but they're up today because people have suddenly realised that there's going to be more people wanting or able to buy houses.
Yeah, so no end in sight to that cycle. Then let's talk quickly. I mean, the budget overall was, I think, fairly interesting. We had some more news there about EIS, which the personal finance team will know. EIS, Enterprise Investment Schemes for smaller businesses. A lot of support for things like green energy and electric cars and R&D. Yeah, helping getting Britain in shape for the post-Brexit world, which we've covered. Lots of specifically around tech that Megan has covered in the piece as well. And we've spoken ad nauseum about electric cars in recent weeks, months even. So let's move on. Let's quickly turn to the results section because it has been a busy week for results. Obviously, Simon, you no longer have much to do with the results section.
I was also coming back from a holiday, John.
Nice, where'd you go?
I went to Malta, which I've never been to before, and I was pleasantly surprised.
Pleasantly surprised? What did you expect?
I was blown away by the architecture, absolutely beautiful in the old town.
You were also blown away by the Burger King. I love the story.
Oh, you're not going to believe this. Having eaten out with Mrs. T on fish, and quality of fish was fantastic, every single day, all I wanted was a burger one night. So anyway, we pop along to a Burger King along the Major Mile.
To Malta for a Burger King.
just one evening. And anyway, we were queuing up, not that it was that busy. And on the wall in the old town of this Burger King was a frame certificate from the EU stating that Burger King, and I presume it's a franchise, had been granted EU funding to upgrade their kitchen and invest in the EPOS system for their tills. I just found that absolutely remarkable.
I think we'd need to dig into the story to get to the truth there, but it does seem odd.
Oh, there's definitely meat on the bone there, John.
Oh, God. Mm. As it happens, Burger King is mentioned in the magazine this week in the results section. SSP, which is the Station Grub company, runs their franchises. And it's been a great... I mean, look at that share price. It's amazing. Up, up and up. Well, so, all those late-night burritos.
It just shows the appetite of the UK consumer for junk food.
Yes, indeed it does, especially late-night junk food at stations. Jonas, on the same page, New River Retail.
Mm.
Not New River Retail anymore.
No, New River REIT.
Why have they changed their name? Because they've become a REIT.
Yes,
presumably.
Yes.
This is an interesting company. I've always been very sceptical of what they do. In fact, I think I had a bet with Stephen Wilmot, who was your property predecessor, that I could not get my head around this model because I knew what they owned out near me. Horrible things. But this has been a great investment. You've still got them on a buy.
Yeah, well, they've just picked the sort of bits of the retail side which everyone's running away from that is growth, convenience shopping. People are shunning the hypermarkets and they're sort of popping around the corner and coming back with their brown paper bags as they did in all the US films. And it's a fast-growing side. And they also identify investment opportunities. I mean, I think recently they bought Bexley Shopping Centre, and I kind of, or Bexley Heath Shopping Centre, sorry.
You know it?
Yeah, I used to live close by and I sort of groaned, you know, why would you buy a shopping centre which is 5 miles from Bluewater and 6 miles from Lakeside?
And I bet it's not the prettiest of shopping centres either.
No, but they've refurbed it, and also there's a lot of space over the top, which can be used for residential.
It's funny you say that. The one they bought near me, which is in a town called Witham, It's a very old, you know, sort of 60s concrete, very old-fashioned retail scheme. But above it, they have offices, which they've turned into gyms. They've let it out to gym owners, operators. And, yeah, I mean, it's done really well.
Yeah, the management team there is very experienced. I mean, the one I like about them is they bought a pub chain or a load of pubs from Marston's, and they use the car parks because nobody drives to the pub anymore. And they used the car parks and built convenience stores. And they've got a tie-up with the Co-op. And that's doing really well.
Indeed. No, it's an interesting company. Thank you. Plenty more results in the magazine this week. I mean, absolutely loads. Absolutely loads. It's a busy enough time of year as it is. Mm-hmm. And then we get a results rush on top of that and a budget. We've had two budgets this year now. Budget day is horrible. From a production perspective.
you'll be better off in 2018, though, John.
Yes, so I hear. Anyway, I think, as I say, loads more in the magazine, but we don't have the time or the personnel in this room to go through it all. So thank you, Simon, and thank you, Jonas, for your valuable contributions today. As I say, 15 or 16 pages of results, all the usual tips and tip updates, plenty in the personal finance and fun section, including some budget coverage, which they'll be talking about on their podcast tomorrow. The cover feature is interesting this week, written by Daniel Liberto, formerly of this parish, now lives out in Italy, Sicily, in fact. Lucky Daniel. But he's written a piece on us about director dealings, which is much looked at, poorly understood. Did you look at director dealings, Simon, when you were...
I looked at them in my last book, and so I'm going to be looking at them in my new book as well, John.
You might want to read this feature.
I certainly will.
If you want to borrow any of it, give us a shout and sell you the copyright.
As generous as ever, John.
Oh, in fact, you mentioned a case study you'd be looking at for the development of a new product we're working on at the moment for the new year. But you're borrowing that case study for your book as well.
I am. It's incredibly interesting and it's incredibly informative as well. So
I'll send you the bill. Anyway, yeah, no, it's a great feature looking at the essentially what you should be looking at when you're trying to get to the bottom of directed dealings. Dan's a great writer. And yes, of course, rounding off the feature section, Philip Ryland has finally finished his 50 Objects That Define Investing with a really interesting feature about some objects that really define growth, income and recovery, which I guess are some of the key things that we look for in investing. So it's a great read. We're going to be rounding them all up on the website, and so you can go back to the beginning and read them all. They are fantastic, fantastically written, and very, very informative. Anyway, thank you all for listening. Thank you, Jonas. Thank you, Simon. We will be back again next week, getting close to Christmas, getting busy, lots to write about. Speak soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.